sometimes you see a picture and you think, I bet there's a story that goes with that. This is me and my family just having a casual time. My kids Facebooked this picture a while back. And come on in. I think most of the seats are already taken. But there are places along the wall.
They didn't caption the disciplinary measures, did they?
What's that?
They didn't caption it as discipline, right?
Yeah, no, it's not actually. But they did Facebook this picture, and there was a lot of chatter about it. And then several remarks on Facebook were along the lines of sort of this. Why is Jeff holding Glamdring? And where did you guys get that work? And so you've got to respond that way to a picture like this. You got to know some things, you know, first. First of all, you've got to know the Childers, and there are kind of several layers to that. But and especially their fanaticism about Tolkien. But you also have to know a story well enough to recognize certain elements when you spot them. And that's what we talked a lot about yesterday. We can recognize big stories when we see features from those stories that show up in other stories, including the stories of our lives. And we talked a little bit yesterday about why Tolkien is so popular and how what's happened in those stories connects with what people deeply long to know about and want to believe about their life and about the world. Now, this is a story, as we said, that includes a lot of crazy elements like dwarves and elves and dragons and hobbits. But the reason the story works so well is because it's actually very realistic and it is modern. And it also has a lot of optimism. And not all authors of Tolkien's time did. Tolkien is one of these so-called traumatized authors of the middle part of the 20th century, war veterans. People like William Golding, Lord of the Flies, people like Vonnegut, Slaughterhouse-Five, and authors like Orwell, Animal Farm in 1984, and these kinds of authors often used, they were highly imaginative, and in their novels, they often used fantasy elements or science fiction, but it wasn't because they were escaping. It was because they'd experienced some of the deep evils of the 20th century. And many of the official explanations for those crises just didn't ring true. In fact, a lot of times those official explanations sounded like more part of the darkness than a way to sort of understand what was going on and why it was. And so they turned to science fiction, they turned to fantasy to talk about it. One of the things that sets Tolkien apart, along with some other authors, including we mentioned C.S. Lewis briefly yesterday, is that these authors face the darkness, but they bring a gospeled kind of optimism to the telling of that story. So let's review just briefly. Christian Apocalyptic is trying to give you a way of seeing the events of the world that move according to a different story than it might look on the surface. And that's what Tolkien's story is doing. And his stories are marked by what he calls eucatastrophe. If you weren't here for yesterday's pronunciation lesson, because that's what I've been getting all week, is, wait, that's an interesting class. How do we pronounce it? And that's why people are here, of course. It's not that hard. It's eucatastrophe. It's a good catastrophe. It's a good bad turn. And Tolkien's stories sort of turn on these eucatastrophic moments. Like Frodo and Sam, we discussed this yesterday, we're in a story. We're in a big story and have roles to play. And that story is often a grim story. Tolkien said this in one of his letters, actually, I'm a Christian. Well, that should mean a lot of things, right? Here's one of the things it means. So I don't expect history to be anything but a long defeat, though it contains some samples of final victory. Now, you may recognize that expression, the long defeat, because that's an expression that Galadriel uses when she's talking about the millennia-long struggle against the enemy that she's been engaged in. And Tolkien thought that that expression captures well what the human story is. Living in this world, at its best, it is the story of a long defeat. That's our story. But in the middle of the dramatic climax of the story, there are these moments of eucatastrophe. Sudden, seemingly disastrous turns that actually are really good and that turn the thing in the direction of a victory. And those eucatastrophic moments give you this glimpse of what's really going on under the surface and how things really are moving in the direction of a final victory. And so, as we talked about yesterday, in the story of Jesus Christ, the incarnation of Jesus, his birth, was the eucatastrophe of the human story. And his resurrection is the eucatastrophe of the tragedy of the Messiah's death. It's not just this sort of magical happy ending, but what eucatastrophe is this working out of the conviction, first of all, that there really is a good purpose working beyond and around and underneath all the darkness. And then secondly, that divine grace is required to bring it about. We talked a lot about that yesterday, emphasizing it. Despite the darkness that is real and should not be glossed over and sort of triumphalistically ignored, despite that darkness, there are other forces at work in the world to move things in the direction of life. And the reason the spirit of good doesn't just grab things and turn them and make them right is because that's how the forces of darkness work. That is not a feasible project for solving our problem. It's that kind of thing that created the problem, according to Tolkien's way of understanding. The way of Jesus is not a way that could have been coercive, which is really frustrating to me. I mean, if I were designing things, I could have done a much better job. And designing them in such a way that, frankly, you don't have a choice might have been much nicer and much more direct. That would not, though, however, be the way of Jesus. That would instead be the way of Sauron. And it would create a different kind of kingdom, than a different kind of community than the gospel does. So, for Tolkien, eucatastrophe is evangelium. It's good news. It's gospel. And when you find yourself being pulled into a story that moves the way the Lord of the Rings moves, then chances are good you'd like the gospel too, because the gospel has the same moves, the same instincts, the same virtues when it's being represented fairly as this story does. And there are a lot of ways to talk about that. What I'd like to do is just hit on a few discussion points, if you will, talking points, places where if you wanted to, you could start conversations with people who love the story, love Tolkien, and aren't necessarily thinking so much about its connections with the gospel. And that's going to bring us, of course, to your favorite piece of jewelry and mine, the Ring of Sauron. The ring gets us into some of the distinctions between these different projects for engaging the world in its problems. And the ring represents a very common one. That's all about control. We could fix things if we could just get control of it. I could fix the economy if I would just get control. If we could just get Washington under control, then we could fix things. If I could just control my church, we would fix things. If I could control my wife, oh my, things would be so much better, right? This is a common strategy. If I could just get enough control, just enough power, then we'd be able to solve our problems. Well, the ring does extend life. But as Bilbo found, it's not the kind of life you really want. He says, I feel like butter spread over too much bread. It's a life that's being thinned out. It's a life that's being emptied out. Quantity is not the same as quality, not when it comes to power or things or years of life even. And if you try to gain life through control, trying to control my own life, trying to control other people's lives, trying to control things in the world, you actually lose life. That's the argument being made by this story. That is a way to become something less than alive. That's a way for you to become empty of life. In other words, that's a way to become a wraith, to be sort of emptied out of real life and then transformed into this shadowy slave of evil power. And this relates to Tolkien's ideas and kind of even emotional responses to the relationships between nature and technology, which is another interesting talking point coming out of The Lord of the Rings. Now, Tolkien, living in the middle years of the 20th century, he saw the rise of technology and heard all the rhetoric about how it was going to solve all of our problems. You know, it was back in the 1950s, it was maintained here in the U.S. that by the time we got to, say, 1985, everybody's work week would be reduced down to about 35 hours because of all the labor and time-saving devices that we were inventing. Now, whoever was responsible for that study, something really nasty should be done to them, because this has not turned out to be even remotely true, right? And Tolkien saw the way the promise of technology and then how it was being used in the wars, World War I, World War II, and he saw the way the countryside was being transformed so that we could do everything faster and we could control things more, and it really frustrated him. Treebeard says about Saruman that he has a mind of metal and wheels, and he doesn't care for growing things except as far as they serve him for the moment. Saruman's not that interested in listening to his surroundings and moving in harmony and in tune with them in relation to what's best for all. He wants to get control of this stuff and put it to work for his own purposes. And that's what the bad guys in the story do. They use technology in ways that are coercive and controlling. They hack and they burn. They twist the environment to fit their purposes, which are all about gaining more control. And this is not how the elves inhabit their environment. They use the environment too, but the things they build look more like their natural surroundings. And when the dwarves build things and do things that are amazing and even seem magical to people like us, but they're really doing very much in keeping with the spirit of the stone that they're working with. And the magic of the elves and the dwarves is a kind of magic that it's more about their character and their proficiency in listening well and using well the natural world that they inhabit. The hobbits don't have quite that same degree of magic, but they also are people who live close to the earth. So there's this big difference between people who are open to the wonders of creation, and that leads them to be in tune with nature, and people who understand how everything is interconnected in Middle Earth, and that what affects the Shire is ultimately going to affect Gondor, and all of the races are bound together. It's a huge theme in The Lord of the Rings, and they want to be in harmony with that. There's a big difference between those people and those who care mainly about themselves and use devices to control and manipulate, wounding the natural world if necessary for the sake of getting more control over it. And in The Lord of the Rings, nature often acts in redemptive ways. But also in The Lord of the Rings, nature needs redemption too, sort of calling out for that, which I think is an interesting talking point again. And that brings us back to the ring, because the ring is basically a machine. And it's a machine to amplify your will to power. Luckily for us, the hobbits haven't developed very highly a will to power. And so there, you know, you barely even get to see what the ring perhaps, you know, could do in the hands of somebody who really knew how to put that machine to work. But this is the secret to its power, and the wise are very nervous about it. Elrond will not take the ring. Gandalf feels himself tempted. Yeah, I want to use that power for good, but I am not going to take the ring. Galadriel has a chance. Aragorn has a chance, and all of these people refuse it. Then there is, of course, Saruman.
Now, I get the impression, and of course some of these things are kind of running under the surface and they're hard to spot, but I do get the impression that if offered, he might take it. That he might take the ring and put it to work. Now, if you only know Saruman from the movies, you need to know in the books, he's a lot more complicated. Mm-hmm. In the movies, he's, you know, he's not. He's just this kind of very flat character with a simple motivation. Mm-hmm. But that's not true in the books. Mm-hmm. In the books, Saruman wants the ring so that he can accomplish the ends that he's been working on for centuries anyway, to bring about a little law and order in the world for the sake of everyone's good, with, of course, him being the wisest one of them all at the top of it. And so he's talking about Gandalf, or talking to Gandalf, and talking about sort of teaming up with Sauron, maybe for a little while, and maybe even, who knows, using the ring, if we could perhaps get our hands on it. We could bide our time, he says. We can keep our thoughts in our hearts, deploring maybe evils done by the way. And in that kind of language, you can overhear the rhetoric of many, many political speeches through the middle years of the 20th century that Tolkien was so familiar with. If we just accommodate a little, just make our peace slightly with this force or that power or that dominion, the end will justify that. But approving the high and ultimate purpose, knowledge, rule, order, all the things we've so far striven in vain to accomplish, there need not be any real change in our designs, only in our means. Well, Gandalf knows better. And Galadriel knows better. The others know better. It doesn't matter what the cause is, the ring represents a certain way of getting there. And by that route, the outcome's always wrong. That route always corrupts the outcome. The will to power, coercion, cutting corners, which is what Saruman's all about, bulldozing over others for the sake of some larger good that we've convinced ourselves will justify these smaller amounts of suffering and crisis along the way. In the gospel, the kingdom does not come by trying to dominate other people. No matter how good the cause might seem, that's not the cruciform way of enacting God's project in the world. And I think in a climate where many Christians would just like to get control of society, you know, so if we could just control it and make people do what we know is right, Tolkien would see that not so much as part of the gospel, but he would see that as colluding with the forces of darkness. And that's a major theme in The Lord of the Rings. In the story, the good people, like Elrond, they will not use their power to control. They will not use their power to manipulate. They're very reluctant to do that. And especially in the matter of the ring. Elrond says, you know, I am not forcing this on you. You will choose it. I'm going to affirm. I think that's right. But really, you've got to choose this. And he's reluctant to use any coercion, to use any force, to use any guilt trips of any kind. Like Jesus calls, he invites, he counsels, he encourages, he assists, he guides, but he won't even let the fellowship swear oaths. He says, we're not even going to swear oaths on this. This is something that you're doing of your own free will. The way of Jesus comes by invitation, not by force, through surrendering power for the sake of other people, rather than trying to grab it for the sake of accomplishing some end. And that represents a different kind of project in the world. That the key to the world's problems is not mastering the will to power. That's how the kingdoms of this world work. The key is something else. The key is the exercise of transformative mercy in acts of risky surrender and self-sacrifice.
Maybe Bilbo didn't kill him when he had the chance.
It was pity instead. Many that lived deserved death, and some that died deserve life. Can you give it to them, Frodo? Do not be too eager to deal out death and judgment. Even the wise conceal their enemies. pity you, Bilbo. May you rule effectively.
This, on the light spectrum. The pity of Bilbo, that's an expression that shows up in all three volumes. It's really important. It's a eucatastrophic piece in the story. And this Christian virtue is all over the story in many different ways. Bilbo shows this pity with Gollum. And of course, Frodo, once he has seen Gollum, shows the very same pity. Sam has a harder time, you know, mustering the pity. Although you may notice, if you're reading the story, after Sam himself has carried the ring, he does show more signs of pity towards Gollum because he's experienced a little better what it is that's going on. At the end of the story, not in the movies, in the books, Frodo encounters Saruman and has his life in his hands and would seem to be, you know, well within his rights to exercise some kind of vengeance on Saruman. He will not do it. And he restrains the others from violence. He won't take up weapons anymore, in fact, after having experienced what he's done on this journey. Surrendering this need to control and to even to take revenge where it seems warranted, that's a risky move. It entails loss. It entails possibly, you know, paying with your life even. But it also creates new possibilities for creative futures that no one could have foreseen otherwise. And that's a big part of this story. Who could have foreseen what the death of Jesus would accomplish? Who could have foreseen what Bilbo's pity in relation to Gollum might mean? Of course, he's the one who ends up destroying the ring, right? Rather than the will to power, forgiveness, mercy, pity, self-surrender, sacrifice, putting yourself at risk, laying down life for the sake of another, that's what it takes to break the spell, to dominate the temptation to dominate. And when that impulse catches on, the impulse to live by that kind of a story, to play into that catastrophic move, then a whole different kind of community comes into existence.
Not 10,000 men could you do this. It is folly.
Have you heard nothing Lord Elrond has said? The ring must be destroyed.
I suppose you think you're the one to do it.
And if we fail, what then? What happens when Sauron takes back what is his?
I will be dead before I see the ring in the hands of an elf.
Where will you
go? No, I'm just an elf.
So in the council, the ring is having its way with the group, right? Sort of taunting people with their old
grievances and their old grudges, which are legitimate in a lot of ways, appealing to their usual ways of doing business, which has to do with protecting themselves and their territories and their possessions and their rights, and being sure to defend themselves over against the ambitions of others, using force, distracting people into obsessing with their own needs. And then Frodo does a hobbity kind of thing, and he just surrenders himself, and that creates this cascading effect. All of a sudden, everything changes. It breaks the spell and evokes the same kind of sacrifice in others, forming new relationships, not on the basis of the will to power, but on the basis of sacrifice and service. I love the scene in the film because it captures that theme in the book really well. Mm-hmm. And it captures what cruciform living is meant to do. It's one of the best arguments for why church matters, actually. It's a really good scene in that way. And this kind of theme shows up in lots of places in the book. But at the Falls of Rauros, there's another great example of this, where Frodo has decided, this ring is tearing people up. I've got to do this myself. And he's willing to take on the risk and the burden on his own, and he wants to leave and do it on his own so that the others won't have to suffer. And that triggers a cascade of surrender and sacrifice for the sake of others. So Aragorn says, okay, I get it. And then he's willing to go face this mob of Uruk-hai, laying down his life to protect Frodo. And when Boromir sees them coming for Merry and Pippin, even though he's been deeply tempted by this will-to-power mechanism, he's also been affected by the habits and practices of the Fellowship. And so when they come for those two hobbits, he stands in the way and he gives his life for them. And when they see that happening, what do? They throw themselves at the Uruk-hai, you know, in futility, but they're trying to protect Boromir. And then Sam, when he sees what Frodo's going to do, he has no clue what he's getting himself into, and he's terrified out of his wits. He knows he's throwing away his life, but for the sake of another, he plunges into the deep end of that whole thing. This kind of move, where fellowship and relationship and a hopeful project in the world might orient around mercy, forgiveness, surrender, and sacrifice, rather than the will to power, is a huge piece of what the Lord of the Rings, it's a great talking point, I think, a huge piece of what it has to offer. And it is at the heart of why they're able to win. Okay? This whole way of functioning is the key to Sauron's defeat. The reason Sauron loses is because he doesn't have any imagination. He cannot imagine that someone actually would choose not to work things this way, would actually give up the ring, when it's so obviously a shortcut to getting things, you know, done that you need getting done. And he can't picture that. He can't fathom that. And so Gandalf says that, yeah, it's foolish to walk in there and kind of throw the ring in. Well, let that be our cloak, because there's no way he's going to be able to predict that we would do this. The will to power is a fairly simple project leading to very predictable mechanisms. But this business of a person being willing to lay down their own life for the sake of others, now we're talking about creative behavior. New opportunities, new options, paths opening up that you couldn't have foreseen before, new solutions. When people forgive and when they show mercy, that's when exciting things start to happen and opening up surprising possibilities in the story. Who would expect to find strength in weakness, or that you could find life by losing it, or that the way to power is by giving up power and the principalities of the world? This is even transformative for Sméagol and Gollum. This attitude of mercy Frodo shows Gollum enables Sméagol to come back out. Sméagol experiences a resurrection because he's shown mercy and acceptance and love. And he wrestles with that a lot, but there's a chance of being restored to whole life simply because he's experienced that kind of mercy. And who could have guessed that so much could be accomplished through such small agents. Elrond talks about this in these quotes from Fellowship, how that sometimes the most important things are going to be done by very small hands. And certainly that characterizes the hobbits. They don't have many ambitions. They just want to live well and smoke pipe weed and enjoy good food and work, you know, with land and have, enjoy family and die well and all of that. And so they become the perfect servants, the ones who are so close to this way of living where the first shall be last and the last shall be first. But it's an important theme in the gospel and as well as in the Lord of the Rings. And it shows up all over the story. But here's some people's, many people's favorite scene, or one of their favorites.
Come on, Mr. Frodo. I can't carry it for you. But I can't carry you. Come on!
Sam as maybe the real hero in the story, you know, and even though he's one that understands some of the least and has the least capacities that the big shots of the world would recognize as being very important, but he's faithful, he knows his stature, he knows who he is, he just does what he can do, and he's willing to surrender himself over and over again, and that makes the story work. Sam is like an agent of you catastrophe more than once in The Lord of the Rings. And there are these great moments, especially after Sam has the ring, you know, puts it on, and finally he understands the ring is this opportunity to gain power. We don't have to do things the way we've been doing things. We could just get control of them and make things the way they're meant to be. And so he starts to imagine what that would look like. I could become Samwise the Strong, hero of the age, and set everything right. And that would look like a lovely garden. Knows what Sam's got in his imagination. And it's hard even to imagine what Sauron would be saying if he knew that this is what Sam thought he might do with the ring. You know, it's like, you've got this ring. It's all about global domination. You want to create a, you know, Better Homes and Gardens cover picture. You know, just biting his fingernails off with this. But Sam, this is the, you know, this is the kind of vision that Sam would have about how to set the world straight. And even so, he's learned so much along the way about what this project is really about, this gospel project as we're calling it. He knows better. He knows his place, and he embraces it. The method of the ring, the will to power, and force, and coercion, and to possess, and to manipulate, it cannot lead to a good result. And so he makes this sacrifice by giving it up, and then, of course, helping Frodo get to the mountain. And that move is at the heart of this whole project, the willingness to sacrifice yourself for the sake of others. And there's a lot of that happens all the way through the story. Many people give up a great deal so that Middle Earth and the peoples of Middle Earth could be saved. Treebeard's talking to Celeborn. He's very sad because he can tell that the world is changing now. And the Gandalf reflects on how the work of the three rings is being undone, the Elvish rings, because of the destruction of the One Ring, and the Elvish folk are passing from Middle Earth. Many things have come to an end, and there's a great sadness. And we talked about that yesterday, the reality of the darkness and the loss. But it's especially at the very end of The Lord of the Rings, when Frodo himself is leaving Middle Earth, that we learn the full impact of what he's done as he understands it. I've been too deeply hurt, Sam. I tried to save the Shire, and it has been saved, but not for me. It must often be so, Sam, when things are in danger. Someone has to give them up, lose them, so that others may keep them. And you notice Frodo uses the passive voice here. It has been saved. He's under no illusions that he he has saved it. He knows there are forces for good at work outside the bounds of the story that he could see that created this salvation. But when things seem so desperate, the only way forward that makes sense sometimes is to take control and to force the solution. But what Frodo's learned is that it's actually surrender, relinquishment, that opens up new possibilities. And that now describes his life. His life has been surrender for the sake of others. And that brings us back to one of the major themes and back to the whole point of eucatastrophe, the kind of hope that's embedded in these eucatastrophic moments.
So here's another scene. We can't leave this here for someone to follow us down. Who's going to follow us down here, Mr. Frodo? It's a shame, really. Lady Galadriel gave me that. Real elfish rope. Well, there's nothing for it. It's one of my knots. We'll come free in a hurry.
Thought I'd throw in a piece from the extended editions. For those of you that only saw it in the cinema, but where does that scene come from? Did he get some actors and do that himself? No. There are a lot of moments in the story when Providence shows up. This is one of them. Actually, in the book, sort of tugging on the rope and saying the name of Galadriel because the rope comes from Galadriel and falls down. And it's one of those moments when you catch a glimpse of the fact that there is this force for good working underneath the surface level to move things in a particular direction. Again, it's that eucatastrophic turn, and it's happening in small ways all the way through the story. And you see it a lot. It's when Gandalf shows up at Helm's Deep. It's when the forces of Rohan show up on the Pelennor Fields to rescue Gondor. It's Treebeard coming out of nowhere to rescue Merry and Pippin in the forest. And it's even Gollum, of course, serving as the agent of providence in the world. These glimpses of a good story that's sort of working in the background, working underneath. The world is a mess, and yet there are these glimpses of hope and light and goodness. And the people that are responsible for them don't even necessarily know that what they're doing is acting out the truth of this story underneath the surface. Gollum certainly wouldn't have seen himself that way. And yet, that's what's going on, according to this way of understanding the story. So you need people who understand that these moments that happen in the world, in life, in the story, are glimpses of hope, glimpses of the way things really are. That there's a will moving things in a particular direction. We're not alone. There's a partnership, and it's a partnership that transcends what you could have figured out and put together on your own by the will to power. You need someone who can kind of help, can coach you to recognize that and to see that and to see the hope in the story. And those people often lead you to certain kinds of behavior.
I didn't think it would end this way.
Journey doesn't end here. Death is just another path, one that we all must take. The grey red curtain of this world rolls back and all turns to silver glass. And then you see
an elf. See what?
White shores. And beyond, a far green country and to a swift sunrise.
Oh, that isn't so bad.
Scene in the movies that in the scene that there isn't that scene exactly in the books, but it takes pieces from the books and pulls them together it's so true to what Tolkien believed, that that there is this apocalyptic end through the eucatastrophic journey, and there are people like Gandalf who know enough about it that they can help you understand what's happening and where it's all headed, and they can pull the curtains back slightly because they know the gospel story. They understand what it means, and they can create hope. One of the big questions of our time is whether there's any reason for hope. We talked a little bit yesterday about why that's such a big question. Is a happy ending really feasible? Is a happy ending really even possible? This is something that Sam and Frodo debated. And Frodo kept having these, you know, more depressive moments, right? When he's off his meds or whatever, and he's can't see any possible good solution out of this. We're still stuck in the worst places of the story, and it's all too likely that some will say at this point, shut the book now, Dad. You know, I don't want to see the rest of this. Maybe, said Sam, but I wouldn't be one to say that. Sam has got it. He's seen enough to recognize there are good reasons for hope. Not because he's figured out how to solve the problem, but because he's learned to trust through those parts of the story that have revealed the hopeful moments to him, that the will of God really is working in that direction. Some answers are totally hopeless. They just give into the darkness, and they say, really, there's no point, there's no hope. Some answers don't want to do that, but they gloss over the darkness and the problems so glibly, like we talked about yesterday. Or, out of desperation, they buy into the kinds of wraithing practices that create and perpetuate the problem, but we're doing it for good, you know. Those are not plausible solutions to Tolkien. Tolkien's stories are shot through with lament. In fact, there's a lot of lament singing in Tolkien's work. Just like in the Bible, a lot of lament. And a real sense of tragedy about all of the good and life and health and light that evil has consumed and continues to consume in our world. Could any divine intervention really make up for the poisoning of the trees of Valinor, or the loss of the peace of Gondolin, or the ruining of the Shire, or the death of so many wonderful children of God, or the Battle of the Somme, or the death toll of World War II? Or the threat of nuclear holocaust or terrorism. That's why this story is realistic. And Tom Shippey talked about this back in 2000 in a book that he wrote. Okay, we don't expect to meet ring wraiths, but wraithing is a genuine danger. We don't expect to meet dragons, but the dragon sickness is perfectly common. There is no Fangorn, but Saruman's are everywhere. But in spite of all that, the point of the story, one of the points, not just acknowledging evil and the darkness, but acknowledging where it's all headed, the point of the story is that there are reasons for hope. If you can catch a glimpse of the eucatastrophe that sort of powers this story, well, how do you do that? Well, when you see someone who gives up their power and goes into a dark situation and is willing to lay themselves down for the sake of other people in a way that creates new possibilities, new solutions, new options, then you've just seen it. You've seen the eucatastrophic move of the Lord of the Rings or the gospel. And if you know some people who might like that kind of story and like that part of the story, those are people who might actually make very good disciples of Jesus, because that's what that story is all about too. Okay, well, if nothing else, we now have to say eucatastrophe together. And we've been through the stories, and hopefully some of the things I've talked about made you think about other parts of that story, other ways in which the gospel connects, and other stories. People were coming up to me yesterday and talking about other artifacts of culture, other books and movies that make them think along these terms as well. So I hope that's been stimulating that way. But I'll leave you with Sam's sentiments. What a tale we've been in, Mr. Frodo, haven't we? I wonder how it will go on after our part. Well, we're probably all going down to the Firestone Field, so we know how it's going on after this. Thanks, everybody. I hope you have a good rest of the day.